My name is Danish Rizwan. Today is June 4th, 2023. I'm at WTTW Chicago here with my sister.
Hi, my name is Amber Rizwan. I am 36 years old. Today's date is June 4th, 2023. I'm here at WTTW Chicago with my brother, Danish Rizwan. All right, Danish, what did you think you were going to be when you grew up?
I didn't know, I think, for the longest time. So growing up, I expected to follow one of my passions, which was probably marine biology. As you know, I very much like sharks.
Actually, I didn't know that you wanted to be a marine biologist. This is the first time hearing of it.
How?
I don't know.
Okay, well, so I was very passionate about sharks and wanted to do something marine biology. And then not being super excited about science classes and kind of going into the media field where I ended up. I didn't really have an idea of what I wanted to be for the longest time, and I kind of just arrived where I wanted to be, I think, through some trial and error and a variety of experiences. How about yourself?
I wanted to be an actress. I wanted to be a singer, and when I realized I didn't, I think really through representation, there wasn't a lot of representation, and so I didn't feel like those were really career paths for me. I did really want to be a marine biologist, and I did love biology. And then for some reason, in history class, AP US History junior year, which was not particularly my favorite class, but something about the teacher, who was not my favorite teacher, I don't even know what happened. I just really started, something about the high school experience clicked, and I've always loved history, and I just decided I wanted to be a teacher, and I've always really liked helping people, and then I decided I wanted to be a teacher.
Can you talk more about representation as far as how it impacted? Because I know, like, for me, I've had an interesting journey with representation, and I'm curious how that affected what your kind of career goals and what you wanted.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, what kid doesn't want to be famous when they're little? But growing up watching Disney movies, cartoons, and even live action movies, I didn't see anybody that looked like me as a desi Latina, someone with brown skin and brown eyes and brown hair. I didn't see myself in anybody that I could see on the TV screen, and I didn't see how there was a way for me to get there. So for me, it was just like, wow, those are not positions that are open for me. So what is something that I can see myself doing? Where are there people that look like me? Okay, then that's a place where I can be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's interesting because I know growing up, either consciously or subconsciously, our dad would always tend to gravitate towards, if he wasn't watching television, you know, desi television, it would be some show and there'd be like one desi person in there. Maybe this was, you know, later after, I think after high school for you, but it was very obvious he would be watching a show and we would kind of joke with him like, you're only watching it because there's a Pakistani person in here. And for a while that was kind of annoying to me, but now that I'm older and I see a lot more representation, it's very interesting to me because I've thought a lot more about it too. And I think I was also craving seeing some people that looked like me. And I think one of the first examples of me seeing a person that was like me was actually the video game Assassin's Creed, which is kind of sad.
Oh, I did not know that.
But the backstory for that character from the first game, he was the main character was, his parents were both Muslim and Christian, which is very much like our parents. Huh. And so that was, I think, one of the first examples of representation I saw. Obviously not a career path, but
I'm glad that you decided that was
not
a career
path. That was one of the first, I think, examples of representation that I actually found myself excited about and then started to learn more about it and understand, I think, why, A, our dad kind of gravitated in that way he did or still does. And now I'm a lot more sympathetic to it. I don't know how that impacted my career path. I think wanting to go into broadcasting later on in my career, just the people behind the mic, like you can't really see who's behind there. So I don't know if that had anything to do with it, because I think it's easier to imagine you can imagine whoever you want on the other side of a microphone because you don't have the visual.
Right. But I think there's also an element of a keeper of stories or a teller of stories and making room for the stories of others and mm-hmm. seeking out stories that maybe aren't necessarily shared or told.
Yeah.
And making sure that there's room for everyone's stories and not just one type of story.
Well, yeah, because our stories weren't told. You know, no. We were probably the only mixed kids that we grew up with, or at least that's what it felt like. It felt like there was many around us, but we just didn't connect or have
interactions. It was isolating. It was really isolating. It felt like we were the only ones.
Yeah, definitely.
But aside from feeling isolated, what was your happiest memory from being a kid?
Happiest memory from being a kid. That's a tough one. I'm sure I have a couple. I think. Is it bad that it's not coming to me like that? I don't know.
That's a hard. I'll go first.
Yeah, that might be helpful.
Happiest memory for me, and I think that this really just informs who I am at work and at home, was there was one Christmas. I can't remember if you were born yet or not, but everyone slept over at our house when we were still living in the city, and no one was fighting. It was magic. Everyone slept over. We opened presents at night. We all had our toys. And I remember I slept so well. And I had like two stuffed animals. And I had them under each arm. I slept so well that I did not move in my sleep. And I woke up at night and I woke up in the same position with one little stuffy under each arm. And I was so happy. And everyone had breakfast together. And then they all left. But I just remember feeling so peaceful. Like everyone under one roof. Like all my people. And my stuffies. that's my happy memory.
Interesting. You said no one was fighting. I don't know if I have memories like that. Like, well, I probably do, but like since I was 4 years old, I just remember being unhappy.
So unhappy. I'm sorry. Okay, then school memory. Like school, maybe something that you liked about school.
Probably. Oh, I am blanking. I would say happiest memory from school. I have to have something more before high school, but like I would say like getting into radio, I think was one of my happiest moments because I felt like
I would agree.
That's probably one of the places where I felt like I found my people, like other weirdos behind the microphone and like, we were all creating and like joking around and doing that. And it was like, I felt like I was able to kind of put, not that I was putting up a filter, but I felt like I could take off whatever filter that I had maybe put on or something, and that there was people that I could just be completely myself around. I think that's probably getting into radio was probably one of the happiest memories for me.
What was your favorite part about being in radio?
I like I said, I think just the environment. Like I had a teacher that was really supportive and good at mentoring, and like just the being accepted in that way of just completely being out there and being myself. I think there was just like the comfortability of it, of just like when you get home from a trip and you sit down and you're home and you feel fine. Like that's what it felt like to me, I think. Because I couldn't really do that at home either. Because I think, with the relationship I had with mom and it just, I couldn't be exactly myself with everyone. So then when I was at radio, I was just 100% myself.
Yeah, I think I had a similar experience in high school. And I think that's what drew me to wanting to be a teacher, is the ability of being comfortable in a space and having people, like specific teachers who I felt like understood me and accepted me for who I was and really gave me a space to be myself.
Yeah, no, I definitely think that's a big part of it too. Because I mean, obviously, Doc was a really popular teacher, is a popular teacher.
That was your radio teacher.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, that's right. And I think that that's part of the reason that kind of community was fostered there is because he was really good at fostering like those kinds of friendships and that sort of that comfort there, which I think that's pretty relatable.
Yeah, that makes sense. So given your experience and like feeling that level of comfort in school, in radio particularly, and finding mm-hmm. yourself there, what was any messaging that you feel like you got at home about what was the meaning of education or any goals that you felt like mom and dad had for you with regards to like profession outcomes. Or job, like occupation, outcomes from school?
Yeah, I think maybe early on we might have been pushed towards the regular STEM sort of stuff.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But I think, I don't know how much, I don't feel like I got a lot of intensity from that sort of push later on. And I don't know if that's because I was a second child or if they chilled out. But I feel like I got less of it, but I still got some of it. Like, you know, our father is retired, but he had an IT career. So
both of our parents have IT careers.
That's right. That's right. But he's more excited about his.
That's
in the sense that any sort of a career path I would talk about, it would, in a conversation, it would steer it towards an IT career in some regard. I mean, that is where I ended up, kind of. But that's I think that's the main source of pressure, I would say, is that it would sort of, I would talk openly about it, and then the conversation would just eventually steer towards one of those kind of career paths. Did you find it similar for you?
Yeah, I think I got a little more pressure. I don't think I never really got any pressure about grades. I was always internally motivated about grades and doing well in school. And if I ever had any struggles in a class, I think mom and dad always tried to help as best they could, or tried to lean into helping me find the resources to help myself. It wasn't like, oh, we need to call, we need to talk to the teacher about fixing this. It was always like, you need to figure out how to manage this on your own. But I think regarding like the outcome of education, it was obviously like you go to high school and then you go to college, and then there should be some sort of like lawyer, doctor type, usual, I think, typical immigrant dream type
for your child. 50K starting salary. Yeah.
Which is understandable, because I think, speaking for like our parents, the dream is you want your kids to do really well.
Yeah.
Obviously. There's not a lot of room for dreaming. But I think my experiences in high school my experiences as a student of color in high school, in a very white high school, made me want to create a space that was safe for other students of color, as well as other teenagers, to really figure out who they were. I think we had similar experiences, but like, I think as a teenager, I really had a hard time figuring out who I was and what I liked. And it, for me as a young child, it was all about pleasing other people and filling a role that I felt I needed to fill for other people. And I felt like in high school I could kind of spread my wings and fly a little bit more with the help and guidance of some really, really amazing teachers in a safe space. And I wanted to be that safe space for my own students.
So you're saying you felt that pretty early on for yourself?
In high school?
Yeah, as far as like being aware of wanting to bring that experience to other students of color.
Yeah. Yeah. I think I was really lucky in that the friend group that I had in high school was also students of color, which I didn't realize. And we're still really close now, and reflecting back on it, high school was a really white space, but just the way that we were tracked through our classes, we happened to be in honors classes. We were luckily able to have access to those classes.
Yeah.
But it was a lot. They were diverse classes.
Yeah.
Luckily, in our situation, and we had a diverse class, and that was not the situation for a lot of other places.
Yeah. No, I think that's interesting too, because I think we went to the same high school, and I think, you know, after you graduated, the student pool was probably just as or more diverse. But my friend group was very much not as diverse. So it was diverse in a different sense, in that I found friends, and I completely unconsciously, but the friends I gravitated towards and ended up were also immigrants. They were just all European immigrants. So, you know, my best friend is Ukrainian. I have a Bosnian friend, Bulgarian, Georgian, Polish. So a different mix, but their parents also had, you know, their parents were direct immigrants that came here. So they were either born here or came here when they're very young. And then I think we maybe bonded, or at least they understood some of the strictness or the expectations that I might have from an immigrant parent, because they also had some degree of that. And so I could at least talk to them about it and they would understand, as opposed to other, you know, other students, or probably the majority of students in the school, in the student pool there.
Yeah, I think that understanding is really crucial. As you were saying that, that really resonated with me, and in my own friend group and in the work that I do with a lot of my students, and understanding just the different families and the different values that they have, especially around education and around their values about education. I think it can be really tough for students with each other, and then even for adults in a building or teachers within a building, in regarding the way that they view students, and the student doesn't care, or the student cares too much, because I think that they maybe don't have enough of an understanding of what the family culture or value is regarding education.
Yeah, absolutely agree. Absolutely agree.
Yeah.
I'm curious, with regard to parental expectations in the school itself. You know, it sounds like it was a majority white school, and those expectations were not really something that were as common among your peers. How did that feel in those moments? Did that, was that an isolating experience? Did that feel, I'm just kind of curious if you could bring us a little bit more into that headspace at that time.
Sure. I can go first. I think that we had different expectations. Yeah.
I think we had different experiences too.
Yes. As the eldest daughter, I think that gender expectations play a really big role here. I felt like it was very isolating for me, as a wanting to keep me safe. My parents were very strict about making sure that I was safe and keeping me home, and I needed to be home at a certain time, and I couldn't go out at certain times. And I remember there was this one instance freshman year where it was our last game of the year, and everyone was going to go out and get French fries after the game, and I couldn't go because I had to go home. And that it was just, there was a just because, and that was it. And I remember feeling really upset because I really wanted to go, and my coach asked if I wanted her to talk to my parents about, you know, coming up with a way for me to be able to go. And I told her no, it was okay, because I didn't want any conflict to be created around the situation. But it was really hard for me to be able to navigate that. Again, trying to fill the role of like obedient eldest daughter who also is an athlete, who is a good student. But still, I felt like my primary role was as obedient eldest daughter.
I think, interesting. So for me, I felt like I didn't have any sort of academic pressure, in the sense that, like, they always wanted me to do the best I could. But once I learned that I could give less effort and still get a above average grade, I stopped. Like, I think they might have been more complacent with that, and so I was able to do less but still satisfy them. But I think I still felt some of that pressure in some of those social situations, or some of those after-school things like you were mentioning. Like I said, I was able to bond with my friends over some of those parenting styles, and I think they like understood that there was times where, you know, my friends would be hanging out at over the summer, and, you know, we'd be there like 4 or 5 hours, and mom wanted me home just because she said so. It was just you having dinner at home. And I was like, no, we're going to go get Wendy's or whatever. No, and it was very strict. You're eating dinner at home with the family. We're sitting at the table. And it was pretty frustrating because it was like, well, everyone else here is fine with it. Their parents are fine with it. They have some cash to go eat out with their friends. And I don't understand why this is such a make it or break it issue. I don't know. Like there's other examples, but that's the one that comes to mind.
It's not about other people's parents. It's about your own parents.
I know.
Yeah, that's a line I feel like we both heard a lot.
Yes, all the time. Well, because again, those parents are also like established in this country and have different. They have different like resources and different values that they grew up with. So our parents are like we're the first generation
right
here, and so our parents are decoupling whatever traditions they're bringing from Pakistan and Mexico, and then you know all of my friends are multi generational Americans for the most part before I met my immigrant friends.
Mm-hmm.
So. Yeah. You know, someone's got a boat in Wisconsin at the lake house or something like that. And, like, that's a whole new social situation that, you know, our parents aren't equipped for. They've never dealt with before.
Right.
So permissions for, do you want to go spend the weekend there for, you know, whatever holiday during the summer and stuff. I think that's something they weren't really equipped for. And
I'm still not even equipped for that right now. You're blowing my mind right now.
Yeah, exactly.
The lake house, man. The lake house.
Kimber, what does it look like when you
Yeah.
What are you providing them? How do they feel about it?
So for me, it really starts with, particularly in my classroom, a physical safe space. The students in my community have experienced a lot of trauma, particularly after this summer. So I have put blankets in my classroom. I put in stuffed animals. I work in a high school. They still use the stuffed animals and the blankets. I usually dim the lights. I direct them to a lot of places in the classroom. I have Band-Aids. I have tampons. I let them grab water when they need to. I also create structures in the classroom so that they know what to expect when they come in. A book that has really informed my thinking about this is Culturally Responsive Teaching in the Brain by Zerda Hammond. And my understanding regarding their brains and how it works and whether it's in fight or flight mode and how to calm their nervous systems down so that they can actually engage in the learning has really, really helped my understanding of how to create a center for them in the classroom where they can feel comfortable. So I'm always happy on the outside, even if I'm having a hard time on the inside. I try and greet them by name. I don't start off with something academic right away. I try and pick some things, like two questions usually from the New York Times, for them to grapple with, like, what do you think a certain image is relaying? Or tell me a story that this is saying. Or do you think that students don't get enough freedom now? Or tell me about the first time that you were sent to do an errand on your own. Just to give them a way to access the deeper thinking part of their brain without feeling like, oh, I didn't do the homework, so I can't answer this question yet. So we do that. And I give them their agenda so they know what we're doing for the day. And I let them know that we're all human. I have feelings. Sometimes I have bad days. I know that they have bad days too, and I usually check in with their energy levels as well to see how they're feeling. And we work from there. Sometimes they have bad days, and it's like, all right, we're going to have to be flexible today. Maybe we can't, you know, engage in a 500-word essay today about, you know, Plato. Nah, I don't do Plato in my classes, but, you know, maybe today we're going to just talk about our feelings or figure out how to deal with feeling uncomfortable in certain classes because maybe you're the only student of color in the class and you don't know how to navigate that and you feel like your teacher's targeting you, which happens a lot. I work with a lot of students of color, and that is something that comes up really often.
I'm curious, you know, to jump off of that last statement you made, you know, a lot of students of color aren't getting that those spaces, or, you know, more generally, it would seem. Do you see efforts among fellow teachers? Do you feel like you have to be that influential role? I'm curious kind of what that looks like within your day-to-day and your peers.
I do. I see efforts. I see efforts. I think there, I am very fortunate to work with a lot of peers and friends. I'm lucky enough to call them friends and leaders who are working to create through DEI efforts. Lucky enough to be in a school that does that, to create spaces, and who are leading efforts to create professional development for other people to really engage in learning. But I think that there are always people who don't know what they don't know, and who, for whom change is scary. And I think that's where it is, where change is scary. And the unknown is, they find a lot of excuses, like, you know, we've heard too much about trauma. We just need to move on. The trauma from the pandemic is, you know what, we just need to move on. I've moved on. Why can't the kids move on? Which is a very real struggle. And so I do and don't feel like I need to be the leader for the change. I do, because I think that is just a burden, not a burden. That is a challenge and responsibility that I need to take on for myself. It can feel like a burden sometimes. But I know that there are other people who are there with me doing the work. And I think of all of my students as my babies, even if they're 18. I told them that on Friday. I was like, oh, my little senior baby's walking out. But I know that some of these kids don't have people out there right now who are looking out for them, who are really creating spaces for them. And so, if I have the energy and the means to do it, then as long as I have that energy and means to do it, I will work to do that for them.
Thank you for sharing.
Yeah.
Do you feel confident that after you putting forth that effort, that other teachers or other people will follow your example, like after you're done with teaching?
I try to. I think that I'm relentlessly optimistic, and I think that it rubs off on people.
Yeah.
This year I have been working with students who have attendance issues, as an attendance and behavioral interventionist, and I sent out some exit summaries to two teachers of students that I had on my caseload, and none of them met their goal of attending school, because we had some situations where they were re-traumatized. But I tried as much as I could to reframe their assets and talk about rebuilding on their strengths. So I hope that as long as I can keep demonstrating how to look at the assets and the strengths that the students bring, instead of looking at them as deficits, then people will begin to see the kids in a new light, instead of like, ugh, these teenagers, like,
right,
you know, they're so lazy. They only know how to be on their phones and TikTok and, like, you know, get on Twitter and stuff like that. That hopefully the legacy I leave is that people can see, you know, the new generation as worthy, and not just like they're gonna, you know, end the planet because they're looking at their phones.
Yeah, yeah. Do you think they have a better sense of representation? Because I definitely think I think like everything I see on TikTok and the generation after us, they seem to have a better sense of their identities when it comes to race, when it comes to age. Like, they're much more confident about what their identity is at a earlier age, where I think for us it took a little bit longer to get there, and I think this generation seems to have it down a little bit faster. And I'm curious to see if you think that's either related to more representation or people like you making people more comfortable in their skin.
I think that it is more of an access to information and more representation. There's so much more representation right now, which is just beautiful to see.
Yeah.
I think that that is wonderful, and that's amazing for the new generation, for the younger people. I think they have so much more access to information now, but they also have access to misinformation. And so I also feel a critical part of my job as a teacher is to give them the tools to be able to navigate the internet, honestly, and the misinformation, and to figure out how to parse truths from untruths and how to be responsible consumers of information and, you know, how to be able to figure out what they, what, you know, how to pause a conversation if they are hearing something that is untrue, and inject the truth or do some responsible questioning in a way that is not going to instigate a conflict, but rather some responsible questioning.
I think in what you're bringing up, it sounds like this process is very active. It's not something that just passively happens, you know, through generations that, you know, one will learn or become better. It's you have to actively pass down that knowledge to make that change or to make, you have to be active in those changes. I do want to bring up real quick that in my work at AdTalum, we do in the UX work that I do for the Chamberlain website, part of the testing we do is to make those websites optimal for people that are trying to come in and learn information about the university and make it attractive to them and give them truthful information about it. And I know one particular test we were running, we wanted to utilize more diverse imagery that was more in line with what that student population was. So we talked to those campus managers and ended up getting the diversity statistics of, you know, what percentage you know, of the different populations were at that school, representing it as a graph on the web page, and then putting more diverse imagery on the page. And thankfully, those tests, you know, we A/B'd, you know, the version one without all of those upgrades, version two with all the upgrades, and in most cases, the version with those upgrades ended up succeeding. And I think it also helps because the nursing population does tend to be more diverse, just because that's the current makeup of who's in the nursing field right now.
That's huge. And I know you had mentioned that you just, I don't know if it was instituted a position for DEI work.
Yeah. So at the company I work at AdTalum, so we just instituted a new position for DEI. But we have been working towards those efforts for a long time, like internally with the company, but I feel like they've been very good about making sure it's not just like the internal, it's not just an internal effort. It's something that's branching out to all the institutions that they own. So it'd be Chamberlain, Walden, AUC, Ross Med, Ross Vet. So it's a value that's spreading out and being shared with all the institutions, which I'm really proud of. And as someone that wasn't actively looking for a job to feel good about, now I know that that's the standard that I want to bring, or that's a standard I want from other positions as far as the impact that I'm having.
Yeah, I think that educational equity and freedom kind of go hand in hand, in that ability to create a space where people have freedom and access to information really gives us the ability to create a world that everyone is free in, where, you know, people are not kind of held back by misinformation. I feel so strongly about education.
It's
just like the longer I'm in teaching, I'm like, we need more free education for everyone.
Well, because the more people are empowered, the more they can do more for themselves. So like if they have the tools to speak exactly what they're feeling or what their thoughts are, they can rely less on a figurehead or sharing information from a source that's maybe 75% of like, oh, this person or this source kind of scratches the itch of what I've been wanting to say. I'm going to share it.
Right.
And if you give that person the tools they need to properly express themselves, or understand how they're feeling and what they're thinking, it'll clear up so much.
No, I agree. We at Big school, impact. We've been talking about equity and grading and how grades can often be barriers and obstacles to student, like literal obstacles with graduation and insurance and all, you know, all these different things. And it's so interesting, teachers' takes on grades as punishment rather than
punitive. Yeah,
as punitive rather than an actual like measure of how much a student knows about information. Like, but oh, the F, I have to give you a zero because you didn't turn something in. But like, an F is 0 to 59. And that's so much. That's mathematically like,
well, and
that's
the,
just wrong.
And the grade isn't 100% accurate of the student's processing of
exactly.
the information. You know, a lot of times students or teachers will deduct points for a late assignment,
right,
which was like the case for me quite a bit. It wasn't accurate of how much I was ingesting the content, but
right.
that's still, you know, a student
it's
that's
also
on the
inaccurate,
cusp.
Yeah.
Yeah, a student on the cusp of a B or C turns it in late. Now it's failing.
Right. It's just so interesting because it's inequitable.
Mm-hmm.
So it's so interesting. There's so many questions now, I feel like, in the educational world, like regarding equity and inclusion and diversity. What does it mean for us to be learning this? What does it mean for a student to be expressing how they're learning it? What does it mean to include diversity in our imaging and in our representation? Because it means so much, right? Like when you are looking at a website, if you're only seeing faces that are not your own, but that is going to send an unconscious message to your brain
yeah.
that you are not part of this population. So, you know, yeah, it means so much, that representation. It just, there's so many parts to equity. I could talk about it forever.
We could. I feel a lot more strongly about representation than I used to. Cause you know, like I said, I used to make fun of our dad for it. And now I mean, it means a lot to me too, because my wife finds entertainment with representation of like people like me, and you know, my wife is American born; she's Polish Irish.
Yeah.
But it's very. I find it. It feels good for her to find that representation and for it to be so readily available.
Right. Well, and like for the girls, like for my two daughters, it is amazing to find representation for them. They can see people that look like them on the TV with dark hair and dark eyes and who speak Spanish, you know, or who are also Desi, you know, who are Latina. They are just, it just feels so good. They take it for granted, which I love. Like, take it for granted. That's beautiful.
It should only go up from here.
Yeah. Yeah. They're like, Santiago of the Seas. And he's like talking in Spanish to his little coqui, his little frog. And I'm like, beautiful. Okay. Done. Let's watch it.
Yeah, I'll let you take that after this, but I think like I feel like your kids are really well equipped to be comfortable in their own skin because of you and your acknowledgement of what your experiences were, how you want to change them, and what you're actively doing as a teacher to change it. So I'm very hopeful for the experiences your kids are going to have because. And you also have a Latino husband, and he's just as diverse as you are. And I think the pair of you are well-equipped because you've had those conversations. You're very conscious about the kind of upbringing you want for them, and you're very good about putting them in situations or environments where they're going to feel comfortable in their own skin. And I see no reason why that wouldn't continue. And I think with representation the way it is and how it's only going to improve from here on up, I think they're going to have a really positive experience with finding their own identities and just being comfortable with who they are.
Right.
And I would hope the same for my kids.
Thank you. I would hope the same for your unborn children.
Yeah.
Timestamp? No, just kidding. My husband is also Latino, and like Donish said, he's also very diverse. He's Irish Panamanian, and so he presents as very white, but he's Latino, born and raised in Panama. And I have the same hopes for my children. I think that we are very intentional, about making sure that our girls first and foremost know that they are confident, strong, young humans, young people, and that kindness is the most important thing. And we do affirmations daily before bed. You are strong. You are kind. You have a strong body, you do all these things amazingly, and to know that school is a safe place to learn things and to explore things, and really to be kind and stand up for others, that if they see anybody who is being put down or who is sad, to help create a safe space for them as well. And that if someone, be it adult or child, is doing something that they feel like is not okay, that they can always tell us and we will not be mad. So I want us to be a safe space for them, and I want school to be a safe space for them as well.
We're reaching the end of the time, but I just want to leave the space if there are kind of culminating thoughts or other remarks that you'd like to make that you maybe haven't had the time to make thus far.
Thinking.
I check my notes.
Yeah.
I do have one. I think that through living through the pandemic, as a teacher, and this is my 11th year teaching, really shifted the lens of the way that I looked at education, and it really put a spotlight on inequities in school, particularly in my school district, for those who have and those who have not. And for me, it really highlighted the importance of making sure that I am really doing everything I can to make sure that I am leveling the playing field in my classroom, so that I'm giving a spot and a voice to everyone, so that everyone can achieve well and achieve success in my classroom. Something that I was reflecting on actually this weekend was that I think that this is the first year where colleagues and students alike, something about this year, as difficult as it was also really magical in my classroom. I had students who would come in, and they would come in and they would say, "Miss Rizwan, I need to come in for my daily hug." And they would just come in for their daily hug, and then they would leave. And then I had students who were not in my classes anymore because they had left, and they would come in, and I had to kick them out to go to their classes, or students who I didn't actually know who would come into my classes. And at the end of the year, they would just come in and say bye. And I had a bunch of kids who were like, "I love you, bye." And staff members who also said, "I love you, bye." And there was just a lot of love this year. And I think through everything as a society that we have gone through from the pandemic, through not being able to touch and not being able to see and through screens, I feel like we need to really bring back the love in our classrooms and bring back the love to our students and to our teachers, and really just really, really water the seeds there, really water the seeds so that we can continue to build upon this amazing, amazing foundation, this generation that we have that is really just going to blow everyone's minds.
I think that you hit the nail on the head there with love, because I think nothing can grow without love. So people can't succeed without being supported. And I think it's really important to make people feel love. And I think starting with education, we've had this conversation many times as far as like the most change will happen when you plant the seeds in kids. And so the giving them the tools to succeed and be the agents of change is going to be really important, and I love that you're passionate about it, and that's really admirable, and I'm really proud of you for that.
Thanks. I love you.
I love you too.